It's Destazapod back from the dead, feeling much better. Not feeling 100%, but feeling much better. And so, we must soldier on. I must answer the questions of this week. Without further ado, it's Destazapod. This week we are saying bye-bye to action figure of the millennia for 2022. I have all the orders packed up. Some of them at the time of this recording have been labeled. Hopefully, by Saturday or Monday, they will all be heading out to their final destinations. This is it, folks. 6 2-packs over the course of this year. We are concluding the story of Action Figure of the Millennia 2022. I haven't quite given myself a moment to take in the gravity of that, but it is quite an accomplishment. I certainly appreciate everybody's support this year. The logistics and, you know, the dealing with China and delays and shipments, it has been harder than ever before. I think there is some very valid questions as to the feasibility of this club in the distant future. But for now, we're going to appreciate that we managed to get this all done. I think pretty much everything shipped on time or ahead of schedule. A few errant packages, address changes, things like that, that might have delayed a couple individuals. But yet again, we have fulfilled what is owed to all the Squires of the Slice. So very happy about that. I hope people take the time and truly enjoy this 2-pack parcel. I hope they watch Kenneth West's stop-motion animation film because it's pretty fantastic. And give me your feedback. I'm curious what you think of the entire year. Hopefully, it was a bright spot in what for many was a pretty dark 2022. Speaking of AFOTM, we got a question on the private Discord from Chud I. Is the Action Figure of the Millennia Club going to operate on rolling enrollment this year? If we miss the annual enrollment period in December, in January, will rolling enrollment be offered? Also, might we be able to enroll for 2023 in February, March, at some later date? I have posted on the Patreon a calendar that breaks down all of the different timetables and things like that. So let me do my best to surmise how the club is going to move forward for next year, which may be the last year we do this club. If it is December 1st or later, as you're listening to this, you now have the ability to prepay for the entire year. If you prepay for the entire year, either at the $30 or at the $50 tier level, you will unlock the 13th bonus figure. This year, right now, I think I'm going to focus on Reese, the Lost Knight. This was a figure that I never made. It was an early idea I had during Wave 2 of Knights of the Slice. And I have some ideas about an interesting Franken-slice to get this character finally made for real. So if you enroll for the entire year, anywhere between December 1st and December 31st, you will be getting that 13th figure sent with the first parcel, which should leave first week of February. However, if you need more time, you can still enroll for the full year in January. From January 1st to January 31st, we're still doing enrollment. People can sign up, they can prepay for the entire year. I had a lot of people tell me that they were glad they prepaid for 2022 because there was a lot of instability and they didn't necessarily have the money towards the end of the year that they had at the beginning, and they're glad that they got to appreciate this. I even saw, candidly, a couple people who fell on hard times and were actually able to sell their club figures and make a little money for themselves, and they did that because they had prepaid, and it was essentially free money for them. So, also happy if people can do that for themselves. So you sign up in December, you get a 13th bonus figure. You sign up in January, no bonus figure, but you can still prepay the entire year. And then January 31st at midnight, I'm closing all the tiers. So you visit the Patreon page. Your only option beyond that is going to be signing up for a $5 slot. Now, the exception there is if somebody drops out from one of the higher tiers, I may do an enrollment, I may have a waiting list. But generally, we're going to lock our numbers January 31st, and that's it. That is going to be what our production runs are for the rest of the year. Now, things are going to be much tighter this year, So if you're a $5 patron, you should be able to still buy a single figure from the club after it's shipped out. What I can't promise is that there's going to be public sales for these club figures. It's going to be much more exclusive to people that are actually on the Patreon and members in good standing. It's also worth noting, in January, there's going to be a Patreon offer for pre-ordering a blind style, likely a material style, Goss armor figure. Goss armor is the big project we're focusing on for next year. It's incredibly complex and expensive, but it's going to make for a killer figure. So if you want to be the first to have the inside track on that figure and be one of the first people in the world that holds that in their hand, you're going to want to be a Patreon member, and you're going to want to be there in January when that happens. I think also likely, I can't promise this yet, but conceivably there will be a Goss figure in the action figure of the Millennia Club for next year. It seems to make sense. It's going to sort of blow out my entire budget. These are very expensive figures, but I tend to like to debut things through that club. So more food for thought. Now this begs the question, I am just a $30 member of the club, or I am a $50 member of the club, and I pay monthly. What's going to happen to my tiers? Do I have to prepay the entire year? No, absolutely not. We're going to grandfather in your membership, and so long as you don't drop out of the club, your space is still secure. You're welcome to pay monthly. Just stay where you are, and you will be charged accordingly every month. I got to tell you, I have placed the first order for what I hope is January, February's two-pack figure. And I think it is arguably the best Knight of the Slice figure I've ever made. Now, there is a legitimate question as to whether or not I will have those figures in time for January, February. I do have a really solid backup debut for January, February, in which case this two-pack I'm mentioning would slide to, what is after that? March, April, my birthday crate. So that's pretty good too. But in any case, my point in saying this is I am super energized about the figures that I'm offering in 2023. And I will stack them up against any other release we've ever done. I finally have enough time and enough knowledge to plan these the right way. And that's how I'm kind of approaching 2023. And I think I have the most spectacular roster of characters lined up for the club. And also a much more diverse selection of sculpts and figures. There are going to be figures we haven't run in a very long time that are coming back just as a club figure. So you can probably piece together what that might mean. But I'm excited. I spent all day yesterday, this mammoth task. I went and I put every single mechanical drawing of every single Knight of the Slice figure into a single document. And it's a multi-layered Photoshop file. It took me all of yesterday and a little bit of today to do this, but everything that I've run in production is all on the same page. In fact, I have a printout in front of me right now, and it is staggering how many figures we have and how many parts and pieces there are to play with. And I think, if nothing else, the theme for next year is one of swapping parts, of Franken-slices. There's going to be a lot of really complex production Franken-slices. And I'm trying to make figures that are unrecognizable. We all own these figures. We all have a Device Ninja. We all have a Desert Rat. We all have a Classic Knight. But I'm putting together combos that I don't think anyone's ever done. Certainly not me, anyway, for production. And it's going to be very, very exciting. And it is... It is so much more complex than just sort of, I just want a Star Marshal and just placing the order. But I think it's going to be more rewarding and a lot more fun. So needless to say, you want to be in the club. Even if you're just hanging on as a $5 patron, you're still going to have access. You're still going to see things first. You're going to get news and pre-orders. And I think it's going to be a great experience next year. So that is my hard pitch to all of you. To close out the Discord questions, we had a follow-up from the Robot Assassin from his question last week. When did we get a red Vector Jump? So red is a color that's been utilized in Vector Jump production pieces 3 times, in my knowledge. The Nuke Armor Solo Vector Jump Kit This was without the sort of base body. That is a clear red color. Now, granted, it does look orange depending on the lighting and saturation, but it is a red color. That is a red Pantone call-out color. We have also had, as was pointed out by JT, Firefight in the Super 7 2-pack. That is a dark red base body, orange armor, but dark red base body, and a lot of red sort of highlight colors. And then we also have Vector Death, which had a clear dark red body. So those are the times that red have been utilized in Vector Jump. Not to say I wouldn't utilize red again, and maybe I'm planning on exactly that, but those are the sort of amount of times that you can find in our history of using that color. Okay, now, before we get to the questions that are on patreon.com/JesseDestazio, you're not a member? Oh, you got to become a member. Honestly, you're missing out. You're on the outside loop on this one. Before we get to that, I do want to talk about AI art, because there is an ongoing discussion, not just on my Discord, but broader on all platforms. I think people are reckoning with the emergence of programs like DALL-E or Midjourney and their ability to generate images that can fool a certain percentage of the people into thinking that they are generated by a human, created by an artist, or an artistic take on something. And obviously, tensions are very high on both sides of the field about this emerging tech. And so I thought I would take some time and share my own personal thoughts on what this means and where I think it's going and what the ramifications are. Generally, I think a couple things are remarkable about this, but I think the first thing to sort of tackle here is, should the output from these programs be called art? Should this be labeled art? Is that a misnomer? Is that an inaccurate term? There are a lot of people who are reposting a sort of Marian dictionary definition of an artist or what art means or things like that. And I understand that take, and I do appreciate it. But I think that if you get into a semantic argument over this emergent tech, you've sort of already lost the position, because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if adhesive bandages are called Band-Aids. They serve the same function. So whether or not we're going to call this AI art or AI imagery, to me, is like getting lost in the weeds and more of a distraction than it is addressing the actual sort of meat and potatoes of this issue. So I'm going to offhandedly refer to it as AI art. I don't really care if literally that is inaccurate based on the definition of these things. It's just what I'm going to refer to it for brevity's sake, and what I believe the majority of people are referring to it. You know, the language sort of presupposes the accuracy or the meaning here. If people are already calling this AI art, then that's what it is. And I don't think it's worth getting bristly about that definition, because there's sort of larger issues to weigh in on here. Also, quite possibly, I realize now, there might be some people who don't know what the hell I'm talking about. So let's just back up to the very beginning. There is a current trend. You'll see it a lot on Instagram and other sort of image-forward social media platforms, of these computer-generated imagery that look pretty uncanny. Now, this is because of a sort of AI tech that essentially maps out all the images on the internet, widely available, and I'm simplifying here, but sort of smushes all of that imagery down into these, I guess you would say, cumulative images. So if you type in a pretty girl with blonde hair, it's going to pull and cull all these images of pretty girls with blonde hair and have a sort of bastardized average of what those images mean. And that is what is sort of communicated out. Now, you can typically manipulate this technology by typing a text prompt. So something like, A pretty girl with blonde hair in a field during a blood moon eclipse with demons surrounding her in hyper-realistic style. You know, 80s color palette from movie posters. And you will get something pretty interesting. So that is sort of the process, and a lot of people are utilizing this, and a lot of people are sort of going down this rabbit hole. And I myself am having a good time utilizing this tech. I am not an artist who is hyper-realistic or capable of much realism. I can sort of do very flat, very basic sequential art and get my idea across to other artists who then sort of really pour their expertise into rendering and making something I've come up with look like a finished product. This has just always been my process. I'm sort of more of a manager than I am, you know, a lunch pail artist chipping away at the graphic or imagery facing of an idea or a concept. So what this technology has allowed me to do is to generate usually between 10 and 20 images of a prompt. Like I think I shared the image I stitched together of Hob. So I am able to take all these different photos, and because I have an expert level mastery of Photoshop, because I've been using it since I was 15 years old, I can take all these different images and I can stitch together and create something entirely new that could not be generated by any of these sort of engines. There's no AI that could create this image of Hob I did, because it is a culmination of all these different things, plus my expertise in the manipulation of pixels and layers and transparencies and textures within Photoshop. But this does allow me to achieve something that looks much more dynamic than any flat art that I would do. It almost, if you squint, it looks like maybe a screen cap from a, you know, 80s movie, or maybe a piece of claymation, or something undiscovered. I think that this undiscovered factor is kind of what I've always been getting at with Knights of the Slice and what I do. I have vivid dreams all the time, and maybe this is a common thing for Squires of the Slice, about being in toy stores in different countries and seeing all these amazing action figure lines I never knew existed. And the packages are always in gibberish, but they're all sort of brightly colored, and they're always like, oh, this is a great undiscovered 80s or 90s toy line I never knew about. And I've had these dreams my entire life, and I think a lot of what my output for Knights of the Slice is trying to construct a fake narrative about a toy line that never existed, or a toy line you never knew existed in the 80s or 90s. And I think the more I do this, the better I get at pulling off that little bit of magic. Recently, you probably have seen, I've started using AI-generated card art, which again is a culmination of several images. It's not just one simple prompt and, you know, I sort of slap it on there and print it out. And that, the gibberish that comes with the card art, it's never in sort of English or any legible language, it really recreates this feeling I've had in these reoccurring dreams over and over again. So for me, the madness and the randomness and the gibberish and the textures are something that I could not create on my own, but I can use and manipulate to make it my own. And therefore, it's been an extremely valuable tool for me. I also debuted this very brief sort of short film, only a minute long. I hope to do more things in this format, but it was telling the story of Blue Dylan, the Corsair. And I used AI imagery, just, you know, very simple sort of Ken Burns style movement of images, to construct a story I probably couldn't write or draw myself, and might have had a hard time kind of explaining to another artist. Now, if I can be making a short 1 minute film using some pretty vivid imagery from these AI engines, and use my narration and use my music to tell a short story or give a prompt or to introduce a character, that is insanely valuable. A minute of film takes a very long time to fill up with imagery, or even, you know, the right sort of video. So being able to just kind of type this in and pull images and stitch them together with a narrative, extremely valuable. Now, the downside to that, I came across a very negative example of the use of AI art very recently. There was an announcement of a Kickstarter for a action figure accessory, and I didn't recognize the name of the people, and so I did a little due diligence, brought up their website, and they have not done anything, really. They have some concepts, they have some drawings. I don't think they've worked for any big toy companies. But the most egregious thing I saw on their portfolio website was AI-generated art that was being passed off as their own 3D renders and their toy concepts. And it was clearly not. I think at this point, we can still tell an AI image when we see one. At least if you're familiar with Photoshop or the way pixels or vertices or things like that work, you do have a good level of skepticism and the eye that lets you kind of pick these things out. I assume as this technology develops, we're not going to be able to tell one from the other on a sort of visual, a primary visual level, at least. So these people who didn't really have anything under their belt in terms of toy production also have a website where they're passing off AI-generated imagery as their own creations, and they are asking for tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, for their project. So that's very bad. That is a bad use of AI art. I don't know if other people are... I would hope people are sophisticated enough to be able to spot one of these images being passed off as artwork, but again, that line is going to become more and more obscure as things progress. But here's the thing. There are always going to be hacks. There are always going to be artists that are not performing at the level of their peers and will take shortcuts wherever they can. I mean, I do it, quite frankly. But I wouldn't say I sort of monetize off of it. There was a very popular artist on Instagram. And this artist was at the right place at the right time. He had a sort of iPad with the pencil. He had come onto Instagram when it was really popping off and hashtags were a really great way to sort of build your fan base. And he attached himself to a property that allowed him to garner tens of thousands, if not like hundreds of thousands of followers. He was doing Star Wars fan art. And for me, I knew he was just simply tracing imagery of the characters and kind of burying them under several layers of pretty rudimentary line work with a stylus, and then throwing a couple filters on it and calling it his own. And people bought it. And he started doing his own prints and his own t-shirts. And I haven't checked in on this artist in a very long time. I'm sure they're still out there and they're still making stuff. I think they actually did do an official Lucas t-shirt or something for Celebration one year. But this was just somebody who was tracing. And you could see, if you got in close and looked at the line work and you understand anything about illustration and drawing, they were just a phony. But this is somebody who probably made a comfortable living off of this affront to creation and art. This person did this well before any of this AI art started. They found a way to be a hack and to sort of manipulate the system and manipulate the platform, more importantly, get the algorithm working for them, even though they were churning out a subpar body of work. It didn't matter. They were still making money. I don't know if they, you know, ever got their comeuppance or if they've retired successfully to a villa in France. It sort of doesn't matter because I got to do my own work and I got to focus on my own stuff. And people are going to be hacks no matter what. It is unavoidable. And there's certainly going to be a wave of people who capitalize off of AI art and make money and become established. And what happens to them beyond that? It's sort of none of our concern. They're going to game the system, and there's nothing you or I can do to stop that. I would say there's also a direct relationship between, this is anecdotally speaking, but the people I see online bellyaching about this or talking in absolute terms, saying illustration is absolutely dead, working artists are absolutely dead, this is going to kill off that entire industry, there's no hope for anybody, learn to code or learn to speak Mandarin. Like, the people I see sort of ringing the doom bell the loudest are not people that are working artists or people that have probably made any money off of being an artist. They might be aspiring artists, they might doodle on the side, but these are not people that have careers and make money off of doing art. I myself am a working artist. Now, not everything I make a dollar on is an illustration or a design, but this entire project is all art that is created by an individual. And I can tell you, I'm not threatened by AI art. If I just solely made a living off of illustration, would I be a little threatened? Possibly. But all the illustrators I know don't depend solely on that. They're pretty smart and savvy people, and they have other revenue streams, and they do other work outside of just creating concept art or things like that. So I do think that a lot of the tenor of the discussion online is, you know, the dramatic quality of it is coming from people that this is not going to affect either way because they are not meaningfully in the freelance art world or earning money off of it or have skills that are developed to the level where any of that is possible. There's a lot of sort of Monday morning quarterbacking going on here with, you know, many people having a take and a definitive take about this, but they're not people that I know of that are sort of out there rolling up their sleeves and really earning a living doing this anyway. There's another artist I like quite a bit, Gage Lindsting. You guys have probably seen his work. He is sort of like an heir apparent of Yoshitaka Amano mixed with H.R. Giger. Really fantastic artist. And he's a very opinionated guy. He gets into some beef with people online. But generally, I like his work and I like where his mind is at. I don't always agree with what he's saying, but I'm sure I come off as a pretty crotchety guy as well. And, you know, he's sort of running counterpoint to everybody outraged over AI and saying he's sort of secondhand posting this, but there was a post saying, like, there are artists who are not very well compensated for the amount of work that they put into concept work and poster design and things like that. And they may now have the ability to sort of utilize shortcuts in order to save them time and kind of balance the low compensation that is usually attached to a lot of these skills and things like that. So it can be a benefit for working artists, absolutely. And I think that's also a sort of interesting counterpoint. Now, in terms of what do I think the future is going to hold, again, I think we're going to see a wave of just phonies and hacks capitalizing off of this. That will eventually dissipate. I don't know if you remember the beginning of Instagram, but there were a lot of people who would utilize the Instagram filters to launch influencer careers off of. Because it was shaping photography in a way that we hadn't seen before, making everything look very sleek and very attractive. And there are people who got famous and rich off of that, though they had no artistic merit themselves. They were just utilizing technology to sort of do that. I think also the Fuck Jerry controversy, the hugely influential meme account Fuck Jerry that would just wholesale steal memes created by other people. And there was a huge backlash against him, but, you know, ultimately that guy still made millions and launched a media company and et cetera, et cetera. There's always going to be that. There's always going to be hogs coming to the trough. So I don't see AI-generated art as a threat to working artists. I think that if you're a true working artist, you're going to be a bit smarter and a bit ahead of the curve and know how to sort of sidestep and avoid the backlash and the sort of bad things that emerging tech can produce. I think at a certain point, probably within a year or two, we're gonna get sick of the look of AI-generated art, and there will be trends that go back towards more handwritten fonts and hand-drawn illustrations. You know, these things tend to be in fashion and out of fashion as well. You know, you don't see a lot of the sepia filters of Instagram from 10 years ago. It looks incredibly dated and terrible. So, you know, you don't see that going around very much. So I do think that this will be in fashion and it will come out of fashion. I do think as the ability for animated frames and eventually video to be generated. Of course, there are people sort of experimenting in this space now, but it's very rough and looks almost like stop motion animation. I do think as we are able to prompt full scenes to be rendered out, that's a very interesting sort of premise. It's kind of a terrifying premise as well. But generally, just to sort of wrap this up, I am utilizing AI art. I very frequently do not present it just as it is rendered. I am adding my touch to things. I would not fault any artist who wants to utilize this technology. I do not think illustrators are going to be put out of business overnight. I think ultimately people are always going to have to pay for a taste level, for somebody's creative eye. That is the stuff that you are getting when you hire somebody like me or the Nobby Wood or Ian Amling. You're paying for the taste level, and you cannot buy taste. You cannot AI prompt a good taste level into anything. You will always need that artistic mind and eye. And finally, there's going to be hacks involved in this. There's going to be people that sort of are not artists that will present themselves as artists and will make money doing this and have more success than you. I've seen several waves of this happening now with stylists and iPads becoming affordable, with Instagram coming onto the scene. This happens. There's always a grift. It's built into the system. So there's going to be grifters. They're going to make a killing, and your work is going to go underappreciated. That is the, you know, the living state of being an artist. So if any of this creates agita for you and you feel a little under attack or threatened about the future, put more time into your own work. Whenever you feel these things percolating up and bothering you, whenever you feel agita, put more time into your work. That is your mantra. I will put more time into my own work. Just repeat that until it becomes fact. Okay, now we're going to head over to patreon.com/JesseDiStasio for our Patreon questions. We're going to start with Gordon McKinnon Hall, as usual. How has your use of humor changed over the course of the Night of the Slice story? Do you add silly or weird elements intentionally, or does it just organically find its way into the stories? You know, I think I grew up during the formative years of Quentin Tarantino sort of coming to the screen. And when I think of him, I think of all his idiosyncrasies and quirks and things he puts in movies that are not typically put into movies and stories. You know, things like Vincent Vega having to take a shit. Like, I've never seen a character on screen be so blunt or be so sort of human, right? And I always think that really great auteurs can sort of tell something high stakes and present a story that's captivating, but also have these moments of humor, because that is the human experience. To be a really great artist, you have to be able to combine those different factors and never have one feel too heavy. Another great example is Paul Thomas Anderson. You know, I think of his films, especially his later films like Inherent Vice and Licorice Pizza, which are, you know, divisive films. Not everybody loves them, but I love them quite a bit. And I think that they are both great examples of communicating this idea, just having these weird, funny, idiosyncratic things that pop up that are clearly just extensions of how the author was thinking, right? This is sort of their brain on celluloid or on paper. So I try not to limit myself from having those little quirks and those little twists and those little things that kind of represent my life experience and how my brain works. I think if you look at the landscape of adult action figure collectibles and you look at how those have been expressed in comic form, largely they are all pretty A to B and run of the mill, and just kind of replicating the mini comics we would get with He-Man, and not a whole lot of aspiration or quirk or flavor or texture beyond that. I would give exception to the work of Ralph Neese and Matt Dowdy. I think that stuff stands on its own. It's some of the best just visual storytelling that's ever been done. But largely, if you look at all these other toy lines, and even, you know, the toy lines at the big companies as well, these are just people kind of, you know, filling in the numbers. They're going, okay, well, it's a hero, he has a sword, there's a villain, he has a skull for a face, and they're in eternal conflict, and they each have their henchmen, and it's in a fantastical world. And there's, you know, barbaric weaponry, but there's also magic, but there's also technology. We got guns and lasers and things like that. And we've seen it all before. It's just a rehash. It's very familiar. There's no new storytelling going on, and there's no interesting quirks at all. So I definitely try to just let that stuff flow from me onto the page and into the story, because those are the stories I like to read. I like the little flourishes that don't really make sense, you know, but are just nice moments. Things like Rex Gannon having a caffeine addiction and always having to drink a Rift Cola. I'm not sure that really informs much about the character. It doesn't really propel the story forward anymore. It's not a detail that's significant to the pursuit of collecting the toy line, but there it is. It is something that, you know, you can kind of latch onto and remember. It is a characteristic of a character. And those things sort of prevent any character, any story you're writing from becoming too smooth and too featureless. Next up from Brent Barnacle, what's your take on the idea of reptilian overlords in our higher seats of human power? I think this is factually untrue, but spiritually correct. I think this is a very useful heuristic in which to view the world and in which to view class struggle in a lot of respects. Any sort of rhetoric like this, I think you have to break down into one of two groups. Is it useful or is it not useful? And I do think that actually viewing the ruling class, the elected officials, the billionaires that own tech companies, viewing them as a reptilian force of domination is actually the correct positioning a normal, average, working class human being should take towards those people. Because at the end of the day, they are going to make decisions to benefit themselves and their standing in life that are anti-human, that are barbaric, that lack compassion. Let me give you an example. Look up Walmart dead peasants. Walmart, for a very long time, had a practice of taking out life insurance policies over its poorest and most unhealthiest members of the workforce. And then Walmart would cash in and make a profit off of the early deaths of those people. If any part of that decision or that process seems reptilian to you, congratulations, you've unlocked the matrix. So as with any sort of rallying cry or meme, you have to ask, is it useful in order to get the world you want to see? And for my case, considering, you know, the framing that there's a reptilian overclass calling all the shots is an extremely useful way to view the world in order to get the changes and get reality recreated in the way you would like to see. Whether or not you truthfully believe Dick Cheney or Jeff Bezos is sitting on a heated rock eating flies is sort of irrelevant. It's more, you know, does this construct help frame the world in a way that can guide you to meaningful action? And so for my money, I think it's a great one. Next up from ZStar7's very own Brendan McGrath, I'm learning that Jehovah's Witnesses do not celebrate Christmas. I wonder if you get into it these days and what Christmas music you tolerate the most. Great question. So yeah, we like Christmas quite a bit in this household. My partner is very Jewish, and they love Christmas. They tell the story of having their rabbi over one year and him being very upset that they had this enormous Christmas tree. So I guess, you know, both of us, you know, don't really have a claim to Christmas, but enjoy it quite a bit. And I think, you know, really, like, holidays and things like that, it's what you make of it, right? Like, you can be a contrarian and say, oh, it's a pagan light festival and they combined it with, who gives a shit? Like, if you have fun doing it, if it's meaningful for you, then do it. Who cares? I like the look of a tree with Christmas lights on it. I like the look of presents. I like opening presents. So I'm inclined to do it. As far as Christmas music and things like that, I might be in a minority here, but I love Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas. I think that song fucking slaps, man. That's a great song. Always happy to hear that. I equal parts dislike and love Christmas Time by the Beatles. It sort of drives me insane, but I'm morbidly fascinated by it and drawn to it. But I would say the best thing I ever discovered is, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Currabang. Their Christmas album is fantastic, great background music. They are largely an instrumental group, so there's no singing to it. But I like putting that on. I think that's really great for the mood. Also, having a fireplace, like, you know, you can get pretty Christmassy up in these parts. So generally, I'm a fan of it as an adult. You know, whatever that means for other people, I think it's completely subjective. Next up from Thomas Bucci, what's the story with the blue and orange perfect diver we've been seeing posted online from Cappy Space? You guys collabing. I would refer you to Cappy Space for his information. It is his project to reveal to the world. So hopefully he does that sometime soon. Next up, Lance Tomimoto, entering the Tomimoto zone. Lance is in the same bed I'm in right now. What is your go-to cold remedy since we both recently got sick? Also, I was reading about, I wasn't reading about, I was told by Olivia that there is a respiratory virus that is going around that is a long-term one that really, like, knocks the winds out of people. I don't know the name of it at the moment, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's what we got. I'm, like, at the four-week point, 4.5 weeks, and I am still winded very easily. You know, this has been a really tough one, but I guess there is, you know, much, much greater suffering in the world. Lance, my go-to is Alka-Seltzer cold and sinus nighttime formula. Now, like all good things in the United States, we don't make that anymore. You can't get it. They only have a sort of daytime one. My stockpile has run out, but that stuff works fucking great. The only problem is it tends to really mess up my stomach after using it for a few days. But when I am as sick as I was, I definitely use that. I think the Alka-Seltzer stuff is pretty fantastic. I would also say, you know, a more homeopathic remedy, use a neti pot, use a sinus irrigator, use it as many times a day as you need to. That really alleviates greatly any sickness you could possibly have. And other than that, bed rest, it's boring, but it does work. You just kind of got to slow down sometimes and be non-productive. Okay, final question for today is from Ian2800 on the Discord. How do you move on after you've decided to forgive? Well, let's see here. Without context, kind of tough to answer, but I would say we've all found ourselves in situations where, you know, a relationship or something goes awry, and moving on from a slight or something traumatic that happened to you, or a breakup, or anything along those lines, it can be really tough. And what I've found is the thing that sort of gets me out of being stuck in a loop from the past or something that's gone wrong that I think about all the time or I obsess over, the thing that kind of breaks that cycle is new experiences. When I was in my 20s and I went through a bad breakup, I just basically stacked my calendar, and that was a way that I kind of got some distance between myself and and what had happened and what I was sort of obsessing over or feeling depressed about. So that meant going to the movies by myself, going to a Japanese garden and taking a tour, going to a museum, going to Dave and Buster's, just not having a spare second throughout the entire day, and curating these sort of things I could go and do that would provide me with new memories. You know, I sort of imagine that when you have bad memories, the way to alleviate that is to stack brand new memories on top of that. And you can't really write new memories if you're stuck in your daily routine. You know, if you stay home all the time, if you're on the computer all the time, if you don't see new people, you're not writing any new memories. You're not sort of layering any experiences to kind of give you that distance between traumatic things that have happened. So that may mean, you know, you need a few weeks where you write a list of things you've been meaning to do and you go and do them, whether it's visiting a comic book store that's a couple towns over that you've never been to but always wanted to go to, or taking a hike, or, you know, tying some G.I. Joe guys to the train tracks and seeing what happens. Whatever it is, you sort of have to shake yourself out of a routine, and that requires new stimulus. So that would be my advice. I think it has helped me deal with any number of things that have been unpleasant or things that are particularly stuck in my craw. So hopefully this advice can sort of help other people. We'll see. And with that, we are done with questions for this week. I just wanted to give a reminder before I sign off for today. At the time of finishing this pod, it is December 1st. So that means annual enrollment for the Patreon is now open. And you can sign up for the entire year, and you will secure your place with the 13th figure, which I am going to start working on very soon. So it is go time. This is what I've been talking about all year long. This is our annual enrollment period. The more people that can pay for the entire year, the better I can plan the rest of the year and the exclusive club figures. And quite frankly, the more money I have to spend on those club figures. You're going to see your November, December boxes in the next few days, and you're going to see this thing is crammed with so much extras, it's going to make your eyes bleed in a very pleasant way. I would like to recreate that experience as much as possible and max out these boxes wherever I can next year. But to do that, I need solid numbers. I need to know who are my full years. So please consider it. And you are now free to sign up and secure your place to get that 13th figure. And also, I think actually we are completely maxed out right now. There were two slots open, and we had two people join us yesterday. So welcome to the new patrons. I think this is it. This is our numbers. We're going to start getting everybody in line for 2023. And then we're going to seal this thing off, and you will be part of the elite and the most exclusive toy collecting club on the face of the planet. So it's all very, very exciting. Also, a quick note, I have been delayed by a day in dispatching a lot of the Action Figure of the Millennia Club boxes. We had a incredible wind and rainstorm yesterday. It knocked down a very large tree. So there have been power outages in the area, and I am set back about a day, so there might be some people who get their boxes a little bit earlier and some people who get them a little bit later. I do apologize, but inclement weather sort of stopped me in my tracks for an entire day. But other than that, please let me know what you think when you get the November, December boxes. And here's looking at 2023. I'm very excited. So thank you all, and pizza out.